All right, so this morning, as I just said, we're going to look at Revelation 15 in its entirety. As you remember from last week, it's a very short chapter. It's only eight verses, so we'll have a little more opportunity to go through it, kind of phrase by phrase. But let me begin this morning by reading the entirety of the chapter. Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last, for with them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name, standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, "Great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." After this I looked, and the sanctuary of the tent of witness was in heaven was opened, and out of the sanctuary came the seven angels with the seven plagues, clothed in pure, bright linen, with golden sashes around their chests. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the sanctuary was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no one could enter the sanctuary until the seven plagues of the seven angels was finished. So, as I said last week, We're getting ready to move into the last major cycle of judgment that we're going to see in Revelation with the outpouring of these seven bowls of God's wrath. And we first see these bowls in the seventh verse of what I just read in chapter 15. But the action, if you will, of the bowls really begins in chapter 16 that we'll start looking at next week, as this there's this loud voice coming from the temple instructing these angels to begin that process of pouring out the contents of the bowls upon the earth. And again, as we go through this, we're confronted once again with this really hard truth that the triune God who created the heavens and the earth is now going to take a very active sovereign role in its judgment and ultimately in its demise, but gloriously in its renovation as well. So in verse 1 of chapter 15, John sees yet another sign in heaven. And we can kind of gloss over phrases like that, like it's just a transitional phrase, but this word sign here is meant to convey to us that John clearly understood the nature of what he was seeing. While John certainly didn't understand everything any more than we do with regard to what he saw, we do get the idea through all of this that these visions were fairly clear to John in terms of what they were meant to convey. And they also tell us, though, that John understood the nature of these visions to be just that, symbolic. But they are also certainties. When we say symbolic, it doesn't mean that they were just sort of, nebulous, representations of something that John couldn't quite understand, and we're all sort of on our own to try to figure out what they mean. These symbolic things represent very concrete truths. And when we say in common language that something is a sign, we really don't know that it is. We use that almost as a cliche, but very often it's when we say that this must be a sign, it's really wishful thinking on our part. We hope that it's a sign. Or perhaps sometimes we view it that way because we're hoping to justify that maybe the decision we just made is right. And so it's very comforting to say, oh, this is a sign, And somebody just, and not too long ago, was telling me a story about their son, Yeah, he's an adult and apparently he was up for a promotion at work and was very excited about it, and it looked certain. And then at the last minute, management found out that, you know, he hasn't been on time to work for a very long time, and they reversed their decision and they kind of passed him over for his promotion. But his mother, you know, defensive, I understand, but and also a Christian lady, she told me that she told him that this is probably a sign that he should look for another job. And, you know, I didn't say a word, but I'm just inside. I'm thinking, are you kidding me? It's a sign you ought to buy an alarm clock or, you know, grow up or something like that. But, you know, we use that phrase in regular language. But the point in this is that the signs that John sees are certain signs. And while they're not always easy to fully interpret, they do convey a very concrete spiritual truth. What we see in these signs is just as concrete as the precise writings of Paul in a book like Romans, where we were able to read it in a very black and white way and understand. These things too convey that same level of truth. And this is clear to John, because one of John's first reactions to this is he declares that these things are great and amazing. I mean, he's not just befuddled by it all. He recognizes that there is truly something awesome in this picture that he sees. And what he sees are seven angels with seven plagues. And at this point, we don't really know what this looks like, that the seven angels had seven plagues, because if you realize, it's not until the next, you know, few verses that they're given the bowls that are full of the wrath of God. So what do they have at this point that John sees? They don't yet have the bowls, but whatever John sees, he recognizes that these angels have the plagues. And I think all that we can say from this is that John recognizes the nature of their business. You know, he knows what they're coming to do. We don't know what the picture was or what John actually saw. The other thing that is also certain in these plagues to John is that these plagues represent the totality of the outpouring of God's wrath. And he says, "For with them the wrath of God is finished." And, you know, all I would say at this point is the language here, that with these, the wrath contained in these bowls, the wrath of God is finished, doesn't necessarily mean that this refers strictly to some future outpouring of wrath and then that's it. As we've seen over and over again in these cycles of judgment, there is a reference to final judgment in this, but I don't think that our minds automatically should say that these bowls are something for the very end. But rather that perhaps, you know, when John says these are the last, it means these are the last of his visions. These are the last of the things that he sees. And in this chapter, we see a repetition of a pattern, an important pattern that began way back in chapters 4 and 5. With the throne room vision. And this pattern is that these scenes of wrath and judgment are introduced with scenes of worship and scenes that remind us of the sovereign planning behind the scenes of judgment that are revealed. There's always this picture of worship and this reminder of God's sovereignty. And in verse 2, John sees something, we'll come back to this in a minute, that he can only describe as a sea of glass mingled with fire. And you know, John says, that's not what he saw. John says, this is what appeared to be. This is the best, you know, this is the language that to me describes that. And I said, we'll come back to that in just a minute. But with regard to like this concept of sequencing of things, and we've talked about this many times, I do think that at least in the English Standard Version that I'm using, this idea that we're looking at the sequence of revelation, the sequence that he's shown the visions, as opposed to a strict, you know, timeline that you can chart on the wall, is supported by verse 5, which begins with after this I looked. You know, so John's talking more about what he sees and what's being shown to him. The difficulty is that some translations read after these things, which quite frankly doesn't mean anything different. They're equivalent expressions, and if yours says after these things, that's no better or worse than the English standard. But when you read after these things, it sort of implants in our minds that we're looking at a chronology, that these things happen first, and then after these things happen, as opposed to John simply saying, after I saw this, this is what the Spirit showed me next. And this is important because sometimes John may actually be backing up, not necessarily saying this is what comes next, but this is what I was shown next, and it's a flashback. You know, it actually takes him back, almost like a flashback in a movie that is meant to do what? It's usually the flashbacks come when something has just happened in a movie that you don't understand. And then comes the flashback and you go, oh, okay, that's how this craziness came to be. And so in Revelation, we sometimes see this same idea, at, you know, with phrases like after these things. So G.K. Beale, in his commentary, he makes a statement. He says the bowls go back in time before what is depicted in chapter 14 that we looked at the last couple of weeks, and explain in greater detail the woes throughout the entire age, culminating in the final judgment. So again, Beale is saying what we've already said over and over, is that these bowls are going to capture the woes of the entire, you know, the entire age. And yes, they will culminate in final judgment, just like the other cycles did. And if you go back, you know, and think about this, I've pointed this out before, but I'll, you know, hit it again. Final judgment has already been described as happening at the end of the seals in chapter 8. We read of final judgment. Final judgment was again seen at the end of the trumpets in chapter 11. And of course, last week in chapter 14, what did we see? Clearly a passage of final judgment, that image of the winepress of God's wrath. I mean, the cyclical nature of these visions is really inescapable as you go through Revelation. And one writer also made an interesting point too, that there's a hint of this overlapping of visions, this cyclicalness, because not only are they cyclical, but they do overlap. Okay, they, you know, and I don't know how far you can or how adamant you can really be, but you know, some writers will say that you've got the seals, and then the last seal is the trumpets, and the last trumpet is, you know, you that sort of nested sequence that we've seen. That sounds great, and it might actually be the structure, but the point is there is overlapping of these things. And one writer makes this point that you really see this because if you go back, and I'm not going to compare them, but if you go back to the sixth trumpet, and then you look at the fourth bowl, okay, there's no similarities in the events described. They don't have anything in common, but the similarity is that the events in both of those descriptions are referred to as plagues. So this word plague that's being used here is used in a general sense for all such calamities that we read about, and not something necessarily unique or something that refers only to the very last calamities. I guess that's the main point, is that plagues is used in a different way. And this becomes really obvious, and I hadn't seen this before until I read this. When you go all the way to the end of the book in chapter 22, you know, John ends the book of Revelation in a very unusual way. It ends with warnings, something we don't see a lot in the scriptures. But in chapter 22:18, he writes, "I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. And everyone here, you know, includes everyone, the first hearers, those first century hearers, as well as us today. And he goes on to say, if anyone adds to them the prophecies, which is an interesting thought, because what do we have today? We have books upon books upon books of people adding to these prophecies and expanding them and perverting them, quite frankly. But he says, if anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues described in this book. So the point in this is, if the plagues refers to nothing but something that's going to happen right at the end with these seven bowls, why is God able to threaten the first century hearers with those very same plagues? Well, the answer, I believe, is that these plagues refer to all of the calamities that are described. So I found that to be kind of a compelling argument. But in verse 2, the introduction of the bowls and the final judgment is really interrupted with an awesome scene. It's interrupted. This vision is interrupted with pictures of the defeat of the beast, something we've already been introduced to. And what's interesting here is there's no description of a fallen beast. There's no picture of the beast slain or anything like this, but rather the defeat is pictured in the gathering of the saints who have conquered the beast. We're told explicitly these are those who have conquered the beast and its image and its number. They've been victorious over everything that's included in that picture. And these saints are enjoying their victory. And what? They turn it into an occasion for worship. And so this is a foretaste of the consummation of judgment. Verse 4 says, all nations will come and worship you, for your acts of righteousness have been revealed. Now, I can't prove, but I think that this is a picture, as we look at this, something even bigger than the consummation of judgment, the victory of the saints. And I do think that the primary image here is just that, the final victory of the saints and the defeat of the beast. I can see that is the main point to this. But I do think there's something more to this, just based on the patterns that I've seen throughout Revelation. And I think that when this is all viewed from the perspective of heaven, where time is not the issue or an issue, this picture covers, in my mind, what was spoken of back in chapter 12 with the man-child. Christ as the man-child defeating the dragon. I think whenever we see pictures of the defeat of the beast and the dragon and those sorts of things, our minds, here it's talking about the saints and their share in the victory, but I think our minds ought to always go back to chapter 12 and realize that it is Christ who has accomplished that. So I think that the idea in chapter 12 is that Christ accomplished and sealed Satan's defeat at his first coming. That's what we learn from chapter 12, that in response to that promise in the garden that he would do just that, Christ did that at his first coming. And so I say this especially as you look at a statement like that I just read in verse 4 about the nations coming. And all nations will come and will worship you. Let's think about that for a minute, because we know the end of the story. And we know that not every person will come and worship in a proper sense. We know that many will perish. That's just a hard reality of the scriptures. But we know this is the case. Many are going to perish in their hatred, in their disdain for God. Yet the scriptures promise that even those who perish in such a way are going to have their wills broken. They're going to bow their knee. they're going to confess that Jesus is Lord. We've talked about that passage before, that that's not a promise of universal redemption or universal salvation, but it is a promise that at the end of the day, every person is going to be confronted with the truth, and even more, their wills will be bent to it. They will have to acknowledge it, though they perish, because at that point, it's too late for them. And so, it's a very sad day for many. So as you read this in verse 4, and you see this statement that, you know, all nations will come and worship, you could think of this as similar to that phrase, every knee will bow and every tongue confess. But I think there's something more to what's being expressed there. I think that this statement is indicative of the universal, spread of the gospel or the explosive ministry of the Holy Spirit that we see in Acts that we looked at back in Acts chapter 2. It's an exciting statement that all of the nations will be represented in what the gospel can do. And maybe this is a small point, and I admit that it is, but as I read through this, I see in this small section from verse 2 to verse 4 kind of a picture of the whole victory of the saints and the Lamb from his first to his second advents. I think we're seeing not a snapshot of just the very end when the saints, kind of cheer in their victory and worship, but I think we're seeing a picture, and we're being reminded that this victory began with Christ's first advent, and we're in the process of becoming victorious. That's just something we don't, because our experience tells us something different. Our experience lies to us, and often makes us feel like as a church we're failing. But the reality of the scriptures is we are victorious, and there's nothing that can stop this. There's nothing that can impede the victory of the Lamb. So I think it's important, though, to realize that just as the defeat of Satan began at his first advent, so does our victory. This thing that we're looking at right now has begun. So it's an amazing picture. So what about this image of the sea of glass mingled with fire? There's all kinds of different thoughts about this, but it's really a very neat picture. And we did talk a little bit about this because I think it's in chapter 7 we see this same phrase. And we probably talked, I don't remember if I did or not, about the association of that with the Red Sea. Anybody remember talking about that? Okay. It's not as obvious in that as it is here. But I think that there is an allusion here when we see this phrase, the sea of glass, to the Red Sea and the Exodus from Egypt as an Old Testament type of God's deliverance of his people from this world. Now we're talking about the saints being delivered in the new Exodus, if you will. They've been delivered from, Babylon the Great, if you will. And at the time of John's writing, there was a Jewish tradition, and that's all it is a tradition. It's not something, from the Old Testament, but there was a well-known tradition that depicted the Red Sea as a sea of glass. That was a phrase that was often connected to that. And I also think that it is significant, because otherwise it seems very random and out of place here. It's significant that these saints are said to sing what? The Song of Moses. So it's like, okay, there's a definite connection, to Exodus 15. And so, as I said, this final victory over the beast is really analogous to the new Exodus. And the sea here, as we've seen before, is generally thought of as a picture of evil. The sea represents, or some writers will call it, cosmic evil. This just the whole evil realm. And this is the sea, this realm of evil, if you remember, what came from this sea? This is the sea from which the beast rose in the first place. And we're told that it's going to be where the beast is defeated and where the beast is judged. Very, very appropriate. And I believe that this is the meaning behind the detail that the sea of glass is mingled with fire. You know, with one exception, and I forget how many, there's like 24 references to fire in Revelation, and I think 23 out of 24, there's only one place that refers to something else. Fire represents judgment. And so there's no good rationale for deviating from that in our understanding here. And I think what we're seeing is that the Lamb has transformed the sea, that realm of evil, into a sea of judgment. And that will be the beast's final resting place. The significance of the two songs mentioned, the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb, I think is a picture of God's people, old and new, united. God's elect under both the old and the new, the new covenants, as they sing both the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb. The interesting thing, though, is we're given the lyrics to what they sing, and the first thing is they don't sing two songs; it's actually one song. Okay, so that's one peculiarity. But the other is they don't actually sing the Song of Moses. What we read in those lyrics is not the Song of Moses from either Exodus 15 or there's a second Song of Moses, and I think it's in Deuteronomy. Anybody? It's like 32. It's late in Deuteronomy, but it's not the Song of Moses. But what it represents is very much tied. The reason they sang the Song of Moses is precisely the reason that they sing here. That's the connection in these things. So, we see these phrases. O King of the nations, who will not fear, O Lord? This comes from Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 7. And I'll go through some of these because I do think it's interesting how these are pulled from Old Testament passages. I said back in the beginning of this class last year that one of the fascinations of Revelation is there are really no direct quotes from the Old Testament, but there are more allusions to Old Testament passages than any other book. And when I say there's no direct quotes, it's because often we see things that are almost quoted, but it's actually a combination of two Old Testament passages put together. Nothing seems to be quoted exactly in its totality. So that's what I mean, because there are phrases that seem like, yeah, that's a quote from the Old Testament, but there's always some little tweak in it where you have to put two or three passages together to understand all of it. But here we have, O King of the nations, who will not fear, O Lord? And in Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 7, we read, who would not fear you, O King of the nations? So not a direct quote, but very much, in the mind of John and in the mind of the Spirit. And, as I read Psalm 86, verses 9 and 10, you do see a very clear association. In Psalm 86, all nations that you have made will come and worship before you, O Lord, and they will glorify your name because you are great and do marvelous things. You alone are God. One of the greatest, kind of eschatological verses in the Old Testament, clearly in the mind of the writer here. Psalm 98 also speaks of the same thing, the righteousness of God revealed to the nations, because that's what Revelation is about, is God revealing himself to everyone. Everyone, believers to our benefit, unbelievers to their demise, will see more about the righteousness of God. So the theme in this whole section, this song that they sing in Revelation 15, the theme, as one writer put it, is the incomparability of God. You just cannot compare him to anyone or anything. It's beyond efforts. And this is an appropriate theme because we've been talking about the attempts of Satan to mimic the persons and the activity of the Trinity, to mimic that Trinitarian you know, God that we serve. And there is a reminder here that it can't be done. There's no way to mimic God. There's no way to even compare him to anything else. So as we come to verse 5 at the end of this song, we're really now back to the introduction to the bowl judgments that began in verse 1. So we have this in verse 1, we have this sort of introduction to the angels with plagues, but then there's this break for this scene of worship, the scene of victory, and the singing that goes on, and now we're back to our introduction to the bowl judgments. And John writes that he saw the sanctuary of the tent of witness in heaven was opened. And, you know, we've seen references to the heavenly temple. I think just last week we were talking about how familiar we ought to be with that idea and that imagery of the temple throughout Revelation, you know, beginning with the throne room vision. And this is exactly what we're seeing here, but it's really interesting language that John uses, and I think it's language that's meant to convey something very, very specific. John could have just said, "And the temple was opened, and you know he saw." But first of all, we're told that the sanctuary was opened, and so this is the idea that this is the innermost. You know, this is the heart of the temple, or the tent of witness, as we're told here. And what we're really being told by this detail, that this comes from the sanctuary. You know, it's like in a corporation where somebody says, this comes from the top. You know, this is top floor stuff. This is from the sanctuary. What we're about to see comes from the very throne room of God. This isn't about vindictive angels, who have just been dying to you know, mete out judgment. This is God. And, you know, we talked about the tabernacle or the tent, you know, the same thing way back in our study of Acts. You know, as if you remember, Stephen had that audacity in his speech before he was murdered to tell his Jewish brethren that you were better off with that tent than you are with this, you know, glorious temple. And you know, probably a highly offensive, you know, thing, but he's reminding them that, you know, the temple is stuck in one place, and you people are stuck in one place. You're earthbound. You know, in to use the language of Revelation, he's really telling his Jewish brethren, you've become earth dwellers, and you're using the temple to do that. You know, you were supposed to carry the glory of God to the nations. And when you had the tent, the mobile temple, you took it with you. If you went into a land to conquer the people, you took the tent with you. God went with you, his presence. But now you guys are stuck in Jerusalem. You think this is where it all happens. And as a result, you're not going outward. Which, of course, Acts gives us the flip side of that. That the true ministry of the Spirit is not in the temple, but is in the four corners of the earth. And so, you know, anyway, this is, John is not trying to make that same point here. He's not trying to tell anybody that the tent's better or anything like this. Why the expression then of the tent of witness? And I think that most think that the witness part, when it's called the tent of witness, is actually a reference to the tablets of Moses, the tablets of the law, the Mosaic law that would have been kept in the tent and carried around with the people. The law of God served as a testimony or a witness to the nations. And we don't think of the law that way. But the law, that's why the law was so precious to the people of Israel, because that law actually defined them as being different. Because having that law didn't just mean, oh, we're under a set of obligations to our God. You know, it wasn't that kind of thing. That law was glorious, because that law, you know, said to the nations, we serve a living God who has made his will known to us and has entered into a relationship with us. Their gods don't care. As long as you appease them, you know, somehow. Their gods didn't make such demands. It's like the, you know, we know that good parents put restrictions on their kids. I mean, it's part of loving your kids. And so the law was cherished in that way. So that you know, when he says, you know, the tent of witness, he's referring to that, I believe. So the full weight of the statement that the sanctuary of the tent of witness was open, I believe, is a reminder that the judgment to follow, which we're going to see in the bowls, is from the very hand of God. It's from the sanctuary, but also that God is holy and just. And that part we get from the tent of witness. He's righteous in making these judgments. He has every right to do it. And this goes back to the song that they just sang, where they sang what? Just and true are your ways. I mean, that they acknowledged that. They understood that. So out come seven angels from the sanctuary. And again, they come from the sanctuary. It doesn't just say that they came out of the temple. They came from the sanctuary, so they come with authority. They've been sent by God himself. And they're said to come with the seven plagues. And I think there's probably too much debate about all this, and I alluded to it a few minutes ago. You know, that they here that says they have the plagues, but yet it's not until the next verse that they actually get the bowls with the wrath of God. I'm not going to say much about that. I just don't think such things are necessarily worthy of a lot of time in a setting like this. But I do think that the idea that they're coming with plagues indicates to us clearly that they come with purpose. Again, John knows what they're coming to do. It's not like he has no idea what these angels are going to do. They come with plagues. So whatever he saw, he knows their intentions. And he also understands that they have the authority to do whatever it is that they're about to do. So I don't feel the need to go beyond that. In the spirit of controversy, though, you know, some commentators are also bothered. It's funny what bothers people, but some are bothered by the description that they're clothed in pure white linen, you know, with these golden sashes, and they point to scenes like Daniel and even Revelation chapter 1 itself, where Christ is described this way as the Son of Man. So it's almost like, well, that doesn't make sense, because that description belongs to Christ and Christ alone. But frankly, this doesn't bother me one bit. Because of what we talked about last week, that there is such a close association with the work of angelic beings. They are God's agents. You know, not just in this world, but in you know, all of the heavenlies, the angels do his bidding, and that includes redemption. I mean, we talked about, you know, the angels as agents gathering the elect from the four corners of the earth and all of those sorts of things. So it doesn't bother me one bit that they're described as having some of the characteristics of the Son of Man. They do his bidding, and we talked about last week in chapter 14, the one seated on the cloud with a golden crown. And some say, well, that could only be Christ, but maybe not. Maybe, as some have argued, it is an angelic being that completely represents that work of Christ. So, you know, the sharing of attributes doesn't bother me, but the only thing the argument that is of interest is the word that's translated linen, pure linen, is, they would say, it's not the right word. That the right word is actually stone, because when you look at the two Greek words side by side, it's a one letter difference. It's almost the idea. You say, well, linen and stone have nothing to do with each other, but for whatever reason, in Greek, it's one small letter that changes the word from linen to stone. And there are manuscripts that have stone, in which case it would be referring to the stones that we often see in the Old Testament, you know, that these angelic beings are adorned with. And they say that makes sense, because we've seen that before. I don't really care. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not a big deal to me. I think it's interesting that, you know, there's such a close association with linens and stone, but maybe it is stone. I don't know. It's just not a big deal, but it's out there. In verse 7, we're reminded of the throne room vision again, in that we have the four living creatures that we saw back there. Remember, these are the four living creatures of Ezekiel. These are angelic beings, we're told. And in this case, one of them delivers the seven golden bowls of the wrath of God. And, you know, there's no way to know if these seven angels are actually the same seven angels that were spoken of in earlier chapters. Remember the ones that received the trumpet woes? You know, maybe it's the same group of angels. I don't know. There's no way to know. Another connection, though, that some make, and I do think this is an interesting idea, is when you go back to that altar scene in chapter 8, where, you know, an angel at the altar has a golden censer full of the prayers of the saints. And we talked about what an amazing image that is. Some scholars connect these pictures of these bowls, and they infer that, or deduce, I forget what the difference is, but they do one of those things. They infer that the contents of the bowl, the wrath, is in response to the contents of the first bowl, the prayers of the saints. And they say that those prayers are the prayers of the saints for vindication. And again, that's supported by that same vision in chapter 8, where you've got the souls under the altar crying out, "How long?" So they say, well, those prayers are not prayers in general, but they're prayers for vindication. I don't know. It's an interesting connection. And it's all very tenable, but I don't see how we can really know such things. But these debates are actually good, even though many of them end up with me saying, I don't know, and who can know. They're good for me because they make me jump back and forth a lot. They make me at least go see what they're talking about. And while I may not come to a conclusion, you do start to realize the connectedness in general, in that every section is not some brand new obstacle that you got to work your way through. Make use of what's come before. It all builds on itself. It's all connected. So these little debates do get me flipping pages. And for me, what it comes from is that I start to see the threads that run through the whole book. There's tons of different threads and themes, but you really start to see them very clearly running through the whole book. And the more you see of those, the easier it gets to interpret the book and understand the book, because you plug into a theme and you say, oh, I recognize this. This is a continuation of something started elsewhere. So I'll end with this. In verse 8, the sanctuary fills with smoke from the glory of the Lord and his power. And there are several Old Testament passages with similar language. And it reminds us again that ultimately, you know, when this stuff starts, it's kind of like everybody out. Nobody can be in the sanctuary but God himself, as the temple fills with smoke. And it reminds us that at the end of the day, all of this is not from the angels. It's not from the four living creatures. This is all from God himself and no one else. It's from his hand alone. And it's interesting that there's a passage in Ezekiel chapter 10 where there is an angel clothed in linen standing next to four cherubim, very similar. And in that section in Ezekiel 10, we read that, and the temple was filled with a cloud from the glory of the Lord. Isaiah changes the cloud to smoke. So when you put those two things together, you have again one of these I think fairly obvious Old Testament connections with language. So the power and glory of God are so intense that we're told no one can be in the sanctuary while all of this is going on. And then next week, as we start to look at the details of the bowls, you'll have some idea as to why, you know, everyone needed to clear out of the temple. These are awesome and terrible and glorious depictions. Okay. Any questions, comments? All right, let's pray. Father, we thank you for the for your sovereignty. We thank you that you are righteous, and we trust in your goodness, your holiness, your righteousness, as we see that you intend to do these things that seem so terrible to us. We can only trust that these are the actions of a true and just God, and we rest in those things alone, and we take no pleasure in these things or the thought of these things befalling the earth, but we do take great pleasure in knowing that these are the events that lead to final victory and final defeat of all of your enemies. Father, bless us as we continue this study. Bless us this morning as we enter into worship. May you be glorified and may your name be lifted high. And it's for your Son, the Lamb, that we pray. Amen. Thank you.